Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Right. Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Raditya, your host for this episode. And today we are joined by Dr. Caleb Carter, an assistant professor of Buddhism and Japanese religions at Kyushu University. Before we get into the book, perhaps we can start with a little self-introduction for our listeners, Caleb, who may not be familiar with you and your work.
Sure. Yeah. First of all, thanks a lot for having me on, Raditya. This is an exciting chance to share this new book I came out with. Yeah, I teach Japanese religions and Buddhist studies in the international master's and doctoral programs at Kyushu University. Those for the acronyms for those are IDOC and IMAP. Raditya, you'll be intimately familiar as one of our PhD students. But my research interests are kind of broadly revolve around the cultural formation of religious sites, especially mountains in Japan. And then I'm also interested in narrative and folklore, issues of women and gender and the environment. These subjects kind of come up in the book and in my teaching.
Great. So the book that we'll be discussing today is titled A Path into the Mountains, Shugendo and Mount Togakushi. And I believe this is Caleb's first monograph. I think this is a fascinating exploration into not just, you know, this mountain, Togakushi, but also just what Shugendo is and how it came to be. But before we sort of jump into the book, can you perhaps share how this project came to be? How did you encounter sort of Shugendo or Togakushi?
Sure. I guess if I go, way back, long before I knew I'd even end up on this path, I was an undergrad at a small liberal arts college in Colorado, Colorado College. I loved the mountains, and that's one reason why I chose the college. And I was studying philosophy there, which I really enjoyed, but at the same time, I think it felt somewhat abstract and removed from society and sort of cultural history, and that's something I was really interested in. I was interested in religious questions at the time. You know, my dad is actually a retired Episcopal priest. And so I think I grew up with those kind of questions in my mind. I was also interested in Asia and specifically Buddhism and Asian religions. I'd sort of grown up with watching slideshows of my parents' trip to Nepal and the Himalayas there and whatnot. I ended up actually taking a semester, undergrad semester abroad in Nepal, And it was through a program called SIT, which trains you in language and anthropological methods. And the culmination of the project was a month I spent in the Solu Khumbu region, which is kind of where Everest is. And I was kind of residing nearby a yak herding family and was learning about their basically the local legends and their belief systems. And I was really interested in how such a kind of rugged natural environment around them influenced their worldview. And I think I kind of took those questions. Those are sort of early seeds of my thinking with the research that I'd get into within Japan. And after college, I grew more interested in Japan and ended up on the JET program for 3 years in Kumamoto, and used the time outside of teaching to basically study kanji and learn Japanese, and apply to grad school. And I ended up at UCLA, which has a great Buddhist studies program. And at some point, I guess when I was on the JET program, I learned about Shugendo, and for me, it just seemed like a perfect alignment of my interests, right? In, you know, Japanese religions and mountains and climbing and all that. And so I felt really fortunate that something like that existed, for me to pursue as a student, in grad school. And so that led me on the path towards Shugendo. And then in terms of Togakushi, you know, Togakushi it's not as well known as a mountain like say Fuji, but, as I was looking for, sites to study, because I wanted it to be really sort of a place-based investigation, I came across an article by a scholar named Sonehara Satoshi, who's at Tohoku University. And he's got this great article on the transmission of Shugendo by one practitioner from a mountain known as Hikkosan, which is in northern Kyushu. You know, as you know, it's not too far from us here. Transmission in the 16th century from Hikkosan to Togakushi. And I thought, wow, you know, this is kind of really unique that we've got actual evidence, a textual record about how and when Shugendo emerged at this one mountain of Togakushi, because often, you know, those details are sort of lost in history. And that was something I was especially interested in basically tracing the transmission of Shugendo on a translocal level, and then seeing how it came to a place and then was sort of adopted and adapted to the pre-existing community at the place. So that's how I kind of came to Togakushi as a place of study. And then I ended up on a couple of years of research, dissertation research in Japan. So I was at Keio University studying with Suzuki Masataka, who is a prominent scholar of Shugendo, and then taking frequent trips out to the mountain of Togakushi. And yeah, for those of you who have not been to Togakushi, I highly recommend it on your next visit. If you live in Japan, to go there at some point, or your next visit to Japan, it's about, if you drive now, it's about an hour long drive up from Nagano City. So it's up on this elevated plateau. And then the actual peak reaches, I guess it's about 1900 meters or about 6,000 feet. And it's just a breathtaking sort of cliff line, a jagged cliff line with a lot of crags around it. And you can see why when you go there, why it really would have inspired, you know, religious practitioners and pilgrims for well over a millennia. So, so that's that's how it sort of came to be Shugendo, and then Shugendo at Togakushi-san.
Right. Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that. I'd like to sort of start then by talking about well, obviously the main theme of the book, Shigendo. And sort of in the introduction, you warn readers of sort of looking at sort of Shigendo as this timeless representation of sort of folk religions in Japan, and sort of how Shinto has been problematically been examined in sort of a similar way. And I think you've given hints at how you understand that just from sort of talking about transmission sort of earlier. But yeah, what is Shugendo, and sort of how do we understand this tradition without sort of falling into the pitfall of romanticization?
Okay, yep, great question. So first of all, what is Shugendo? I think that's a good question because a lot of people are unfamiliar with it. It is a religious system that forms in Japan. Its historical development has been kind of, posited at different points in history. And it depends on how you define it. I define it as this sort of self-conscious religious system that really emerges out of the practitioner's interest in being sort of self-identifying with this tradition. So as a self-conscious system, it has its own sort of lexicon, own doctrines, own rituals and institutions. Recent historians of religions and scholars are now positing that maybe its emergence happened sometime in the late medieval period. And I agree with that. And the evidence that I find from Togakushi supports that too, in the case of Togakushi. But essentially, yeah, it's a mountain-based tradition that forms out of a lot of different influences. But I think the main ones are esoteric Buddhism. So the two main branches of esoteric Buddhism in Japan are Tendai and Shingon. Both have temples at Togakushi in the medieval period, but Tendai is the much bigger presence at the mountain. There's other influences in Shugendo, Pure Land worship, Zen, also Omyodo, for instance. There's Taoist influences and then local deities, local spirit worship. So it's quite a fascinating tradition. Now, it was actually banned by the Meiji government in the beginning of the Meiji period, which begins in 1868, and dismantled institutionally around the country, and practitioners were banned from participating in any related practices for a while. Eventually, in the early 20th century, it began to loosen up a little bit, and then it was fully recognized as a religious organization in the post-war period. But with that ban, I think there was a real fear that it was being lost. And so you have a couple things happen in the early 20th century. And one is that priests that maybe came out of familial Shugendo families and were now affiliated with Shingon or Tendai, they sought to begin studying it. And so they really began looking at historical texts and really emphasizing the medieval ascetic aspect of it, of, you know, going into the mountains for long periods of time, worshiping deities there, going under freezing waterfalls, meditating in caves, all these really kind of fascinating and austere practices. That was their emphasis. So you have that going on, and they're eventually trying to restore something of a movement, which does come about more formally in the post-war period. And then you also have the folklore studies movement, or Minzoku Gaku, as it's known in Japan. And it's sort of the most well-known figure is Yanagita Kunio and his work in the early 20th century. And for him, he kind of saw mountain communities as vestiges of Japan's ancient past amidst a sort of onslaught of Western infiltration of ideas and technologies and whatnot. So right from the beginning with him and others, you had kind of a romanticized image of Shugendo as being something that preserved Japanese culture, and also was sort of representative of a national identity and kind of a substrate of the culture that did not really change over time. And as Shugendo became more of a serious academic field in, you know, the middle of the 20th century and into the post-war period, the main scholars were heavily influenced by Yanagita Kunio, and some of them had studied under him. And so that's basically how the study of Shugendo took shape. And a lot of those ideas continue down to the present, although scholars now are revising that way in which we look at Shugendo. And I see my own book as contributing to that. I think it's worthy of revising because the way in which it's been positioned is something that is kind of impervious to change. And so I guess on the one side of it, as a scholar and a historian, my goal is to provide a more accurate understanding of its historical formation. But beyond that, I think it's still practiced today and is being kind of reimagined and restored at you know, various mountains around the country. And when you have an image of something as kind of unchanging and permanent, it sort of calcifies it. And so I think in that sense, what I want to show in this book is that Shugendo did emerge at a specific time period and specific places. It wasn't something that just naturally existed across the archipelago. And it was transmitted, you know, through various mechanisms. And then it changed over time through various, you know, religious influences, but also economic, political, regional, what have you. And so my hope is that the book draws attention to that sense of change. So that's kind of where I see the book fitting into the sort of study of Shugendo.
Okay, yeah, great. Interesting. Thank you. Right. So the sort of three main themes of the book that you sort of mentioned in the introduction are sort of institution, narratives, and ritual. Why are these three themes essential sort of in the case of Tagakshi versus, let's say, sort of the asceticism aspect that, you know, we've seen a lot more in sort of perhaps other scholarship or even in sort of some of these more contemporary, you know, representations of Shugendo?
Oh, right. Yeah. Of course, there's various approaches and ways in which you could study Shugendo. And yeah, I use these three elements. And the way I decided on them is basically just, you know, initially looking through the textual record of Togakushi-san, these were the three things that I found continuing to reoccur from, you know, the earliest record, which is mid 13th century, up through the Edo period. And they almost operated as sort of vectors for formation of Shugendo, also Shinto, also Tendai Buddhism, and then vectors for any sort of changes, moments, pivotal moments in the history of the site. And, you know, narratives especially fascinated me. You find origin accounts known as Engi at religious sites around the country and of course, other regions around the world too. But they're often the earliest records in Japan of a religious site. And they can tell us a lot about who was interested in the site, why they were interested, why they went there, you know, who the community was, you know, all of these things. And then I think what also surprised me was that narratives tend to operate as the main form of discourse, throughout the mountain's history, you know, the texts were often written for a specific purpose, right? And they often relied on historical narratives about the mountain to, say, enforce a new policy, or project a certain image of the mountain, or to adopt in a new form of Shinto, for example. So they seem very crucial to me. And then they interweave with ritual and institution too. So rituals, including asceticism, were the ways in which Shugendo, one of the ways in which Shugendo was transmitted. So understanding the rituals was helpful in seeing, okay, how do these rituals move into a place like Tugakshi? And then how are they adapted to kind of merge with the existing ritual culture? And then the institutions, this was kind of something for me to think about a little bit, because I think in religious studies, often, you know, the formation of institutions is often aligned with a sort of decline in the spirituality of the religion, in sort of unstated ways, I think. And some of this is, you know, probably has Protestant baggage attached to it and whatnot. It's sort of a modern phenomenon a little bit. But yeah, so sure, institutions definitely can be corrupt and represent elite interests. But I think that they also can represent other interests too. And for example, what I found with Shugendo is the institutionalization of Shugendo at Togakshi, it's formally institutionalized in the early 1700s. This is actually in response to the practitioners of Shugendo, the Yamabushi is what they're called, who were facing competition from other established groups, Shugendo groups. And they didn't have their own institution. They were just sort of operating on a, you know, sort of freelance basis, so to speak. And so institutions provide that stability for livelihood, that elevated recognition that they're a member of something. And then it's the institution that provides the sort of stable transmission from generation to generation of rituals and of narratives. And so that's kind of why I focused on these key things within understanding really the formation of the site itself and ongoing development, and then Shugendo as well as the other traditions there as well.
Great. Yeah, thank you. That's a very clear explanation. Right. So I do want to go back to and sort of talk a little bit more about, you know, all of these themes later on. But I want to start with narratives, right? And in chapter one, you discuss sort of the legend of a particular sort of nine-headed dragon that comes up a lot in your book as well. And sort of its eventual transformation into an oni as a sort of a vital part in the origins of the mountain. Can you talk a little bit more about sort of this, and you also mentioned this in the book, but how this sort of dragon represents Buddhist influences?
Sure. Okay. So this is a story of a Buddhist itinerant who is sort of traveling through the mountains, comes across Togakshi-san, and is at its base, and he begins chanting the Lotus Sutra. And as he's chanting, these sort of noxious fumes rise up out of the ground. And those fumes are followed by this kind of grotesque figure that resides in the mountain. And it's like part demon or oni and part dragon. And it's got nine heads. And it begins to tell its story of just having, you know, really all this karmic baggage from previous lifetimes. And that's why it's in this hideous form now. And you know, previous itinerants have come to the mountain and they've died because of its noxious fumes. But now, because it's heard the Lotus Sutra, it has become awakened and it will now become sort of a guardian of the mountain. And then the itinerant looks at it and says that because you're this demonic force, you need to be back in your hiding place in the mountain. So this being kind of goes back into this cave in the side of the mountain. And that's the story. And there's a lot of kind of things that fascinate me about it. Maybe I'll just mention a couple. You asked about dragons, and dragons have been worshipped across Asia, often as local deities, but then also as guardians of the Buddha. And they control the weather, water, and precipitation. So for agricultural communities, they were propitiated for rainfall or against flooding or all kinds of things related to rain and water. And so that's a common theme. Now, this version of the story was written from the Tendai perspective at Mount Hiei, which is just outside of the capital, Kyoto. And so it's written from sort of the center of, the civilization, so to speak, at least as it exists in on the Japanese archipelago, and from the center of Tendai power. And so one thing that I think is interesting about it is it's basically imprint of Tendai Buddhism onto a region that has not, at least from the evidence that I could find, has not been introduced to Buddhism yet, right? And so that comes through the Lotus Sutra being chanted. That's the main scripture of the Tendai school. But also, it's in a way, it's a bit of a gaze from the center to the periphery. And you can see that through the depiction of this creature that is fairly hideous and then is only awakened and transformed by the presence of this Tendai itinerant. And so it's almost like a conversion of a barbaric landscape, which is, depicted through this being, and brought into the Tendai Buddhist sphere, right? And I found this motif in different iterations at other mountains around the country too, of a nine-headed dragon with the same Tendai influence. And so, again, coming back to storytelling, what I think is interesting is that this was a story that you could see as being used to basically spread the Tendai institution, but also Tendai beliefs and practices. I actually traced it back to, I think, 7th century at Mount Tiantai, which is the pronunciation for Tendai in the original Chinese. And so in that sense, you can imagine it being part of the kind of so-called sort of canon of stories in Tendai Buddhism, that priests would have been aware of the story from Mount Tiantai. They might have gone to a site like Togakushi, looked up at this jagged ridgeline, which, looking up at it, you could almost see like the ridge forming nine heads maybe, and then thinking, sort of associating it with that story. So I think on a lot of different levels, you can see the role of this story in the spread of Tendai, at least as an example of the spread of Tendai Buddhism, and then really the creation of a local deity out of a story that had been transposed from another area.
Yeah, fascinating. And just from sort of this story, you can already tell again that the really impactful role of institution, right? Sort of this Tendai institution in the travel of motifs and stories of sort of dragons and sort of this sort of idea of pacifying local deities. So another figure that you sort of mentioned in the book, very vital to sort of the founding of the mountain, is Gakumon Gyoja, right? Can you talk a little bit more about sort of this figure? And is a dragon sort of involved in sort of this narrative as well? Or what is Gyoja's sort of role in sort of this narrative?
Yes, good question. So the story that I just told begins with a kind of a nameless figure. I think the text uses the term Gakumon Shugyoja, which would translate into someone who was both a scholar and a practitioner, a gyoja. And then this dragon, or this sort of demon slash dragon, is also this local resident spirit at the mountain. What happens when I went to the next iteration that exists of this story, and it comes from, well, it's compiled in 1458 at the mountain itself, and you see this big transformation in both figures. And so one is that nameless figure is now a named person, Gakumon Gyoja, really similar to the original language, but that's his name now. And he's considered to be the founder of the mountain temples there. And then this earlier kind of hideous creature is now completely shed its karmic scales, so to speak, and become this really powerful dragon spirit for the mountain and for the region and all of patrons of the mountain's temples. And so that continues over the course of the history, that Gakumon Gyoja is now the distinct founder of the mountain temples, and Kuzu Ryu, which means nine-headed dragon, is now the main divinity at the mountain. I think another interesting thing about that is that, again, thinking about storytelling, this story was recorded at a time of great instability. So the estate system throughout the country is collapsing. Main economic base for the court and the main temples and whatnot. And warriors are now taking over, including in Shinano, the province where Togakushi is. And so on the one hand, I think the compilers of this text are, they're in a moment when Togakushi is now more independent from Hiezan than it was several centuries before, and can kind of, you know, boast a bit about its own cloud and founder and dragon spirit. But on the other side of it, it's a very unstable time. And so I think they use this historical narrative to really reinforce their foundation, their sort of cultural or their sort of legitimacy within the region.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Okay, so next I'd like to talk about a rather contentious topic, but you also mentioned this particular topic sort of a lot in the book as well, and that's sort of women's exclusions from mountains in Japan. And obviously Togakushi is not the only place where you find women's exclusions. I think right now, at least in Togakushi, there are no present sort of exclusions or like any signs or anything like that.
That's right. That
stuff, yeah. But there, you know, in the book you mentioned that there were traces of this sort of Nihonin Kinsei, right? Sort of women's exclusion in the past. How did sort of this discourse of women's exclusion influence the mountain in the past? And what kind of arguments were sort of presented about the presence? And then you also mentioned that there were arguments that support maintaining sort of women's entry into the mountain. If you could talk a little bit more about this issue.
Sure, yeah. So this is a significant part of Japanese history at, you know, various sites, for example, kilns or sake kilns or shrine entries, various places. And then mountains, sacred mountains are perhaps the most well-known of places that were off limits to women. There's been some great scholarship on this history from Japanese scholars and scholars outside of Japan. And so I was aware of it coming into the project at Togakushi, but the evidence that I found at Togakushi really surprised me. And I decided to spend a couple chapters talking about that because I think they disrupt some of the assumptions that we have about women's exclusion from mountains in Japan. And sort of the underlying idea, I guess, in the literature up until now has been that it was a widespread phenomenon from, you know, ancient or at least medieval times up through the early modern period, the Edo period, and kind of, you know, involved mountains across the country and whatnot.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And what I found in the records from this is again mid 15th century, this one text that I just described, there's different voices talking about women's prohibitions from Togakushi within the text, which for one I thought was really interesting. But one of them is another version of the tale of Gakumon Gyoja, and he comes to the mountain and he's kind of like chased around by this crazy woman, and you know, the woman ends up being like a local emanation of a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva Kannon, but he's so disturbed he tells her like, look, you know, from now on women can't come here. And so that's a story that is being posited at that time to justify, or it could have been earlier too, and simply compiled then, but to justify the prohibition of women from the site. Actually a more prominent story in this text is about an adolescent girl who becomes an oracle for another prominent bodhisattva, and that's Jizo, who's famous, you know, in Japan and one of the main bodhisattvas. And Jizo speaks to this girl and says, you know, because there's this ban on women, this mountain's power is weakened, and it goes against the, you know, the words of the Buddha, which I take to be Shakyamuni when he admitted women into the order. And so right within that, you see this controversy highlighted in the text. And then alongside that, pretty close to that time period, about a decade earlier, there are extant woodblocks that mention the kind of temporary prohibition of women at times of menstruation and pregnancy and childbirth, that during those times they're not allowed to enter the mountain. Their husbands are also cannot enter during that time period. And so that suggests that it's not a sort of blanket ban on women, but has to do more with ritual purity and protocol. Now, that idea of blood pollution becomes much more pervasive in late medieval Japan, and that's due to a text that is transmitted from China, that's written in China, I don't have to get into all that, but essentially that women are naturally impure because of their menstruation, and so ultimately there's this belief that women are fundamentally impure. And still, I think at this time period at Togakushi, that's not totally taken hold yet, but you see aspects of it. The next evidence of women's exclusion doesn't come until the early 1700s, so it's hard to know what happens in between. But I think it's not a coincidence that it does come around that time, because in the early 18th century, there's waves of pilgrims that are now coming to Togakushi and other mountains as well. But at this time, the temple administrators at the mountain decide to open up the a nearby mountain that's part of the sort of region of Togakushi to laymen, but that's not extended to women. And so I think there are concerns about pollution to the mountain, and you can see that through actually accounts from villagers below that are worried about storms being unleashed on the site if there's pollution on it. And so I kind of tie this in with these stelae that are erected over the course of the 18th century, a couple of them at different points in the mountain, that are basically big signs saying that women are now not allowed to cross beyond here, and suggest that it has to do with a lot more people coming now, concerns over pollution, this discourse on women's impurity and all that. But I guess it's sort of a nuanced argument, but I'm trying to suggest that it wasn't simply this blanket ban on women throughout, you know, the historical record at Togakushi. And that's a way of saying that, look, women were involved at the site. They were involved at other mountains too. We should understand it as a more nuanced situation. I sort of drawn some other examples that other scholars have pointed out at other sites too, in medieval time period, of figures like Dogen, you know, putative founder of the Soto Zen school, also criticizing the ban on women from mountains. And so basically what I'm trying to do is show through the case of Togakushi that it deserves more nuance than it's received. And I'll just sort of finish this thought with saying that Omine-san is a mountain that still continues the ban, and it's enforced through the local religious communities and confraternities. And part of their rationale is that they continue this regulation because it's existed for 1300 years. And, you know, if you actually go into the historical records, the evidence isn't there to make that case, but it's the belief again of something that's sort of unchanging and permanent. And I think in that regard, it's a bit of a subtle pushback on that idea that these things are constantly changing over the course of history, and they're changing in response to different influences at a given site. And that's important to look at.
Yeah, definitely. I do think with issues like sort of women's exclusion, for example, when they're brought back into discussion, sort of, you know, with new events, like, for example, designations from UNESCO, things like that, as you've mentioned, right, like historical precedents and traditions and sort of even religious practices are often cited as, you know, reasons for maintaining this. But, you know, you take a closer look at the historical documents, and often there are, as you're going through in the book, there's different voices, right, voicing different types of arguments for various different reasons. Yeah, great, thank you. So, I guess to sort of close off our conversation, I'd like to sort of go back and talk about this idea of transmission that you mentioned in the start, right? And so, in the case of Togakushi, what I understand from reading the book is that Shigenda really only started from 16th century onwards. And that was because there was sort of this transmission from like a particular practitioner from Mount Hiko, and sort of, you know, documents after that start showing that the group of sort of practitioners there become much more self-aware and then sort of self-represent themselves as sort of Shugendo and not just as sort of Tendai, sort of these other sort of regular sort of Buddhist practitioners. There were, however, traces of mountain asceticism even before sort of this introduction of Shugendo from Bikkhu-san. How are they different from Shugendo? Sort of, because, you know, sometimes we hear these terms, right? Like Shugenja, Yamabushi, and all these different terms. And often, again, people who are not experts in the topic would just think of them as the same thing. How do we sort of navigate sort of these different types of practitioners? And sort of
right, in the case of Yeah, I think it's a great question. And it's one that scholars of Shugendo will answer differently, just in the way that I think scholars of Shinto will answer the question in the case of Shinto, which is, you know, had similar disputing ideas of when it took shape and when it formed. But I think with Shugendo, scholars in the past have looked at ascetic practices that took place at Togakushi and said, okay, this is evidence of Shugendo. So Shugendo existed at this time period. And I'm trying to revise that a bit because I think, you know, on the one hand, this is true. These ascetic practices continue in the form of Shugendo, but these ascetic practices are also a larger part of a kind of pan-Asian form, a part of Buddhism, right? That you find asceticism in Buddhism in Tibet and in China and the Himalaya and all over. And so maybe it's better to think about that time period in Japan and those practices as part of that larger sort of landscape of Buddhist practice that isn't necessarily Shugendo, which Shugendo is you can think of as kind of, you know, a Japanese phenomenon, a Japanese institution. But I also come to that conclusion because when I was looking at texts, these earlier two origin accounts that I referred to, in our conversation and in the book, there's just no language. There's no references to Shugendo. There's no references to Yamabushi or the term Shugendo or the sort of semi-legendary founder of Shugendo and Nogyoja. You don't find any of that. And so that's where I first started thinking, you know, this is a bit strange. And then putting that together with the evidence of this practitioner named Akubo Sokuden coming from Hikkō-san in the early 16th century. It's not quite clear if he came to Togakushi or if Togakushi priests went to him, but I think it's likely that, you know, he was traveling to different sites and that he came to Togakushi. He was responsible for compiling these large ritual manuals for Shugendo that became the core canon for Shugendo in the Edo period. So he brings a few of these texts to Togakushi and then initiates two of the highest members of the priestly community at Togakushi into one of the main Shugendos, one of the main rituals of Shugendo, which is Mina-iri or mountain entry. And so that there you have like ritual and text that are transmitted through. And then over time, it just gets interesting looking at subsequent evidence of Shugendo at the site, because it begins with Akubo as this fairly generalized tradition that's not attached to any particular place. Even Hikkō-san, if you look at the text, there's no mention of Hikkō-san in many of them. But they make it their own tradition over time. And by the time you get to the early 18th century, they're actually able to create their own branch of Shugendo. There is also a very influential priest there who's the main kind of administrator of the site, very elite Tendai priest. And he again comes back to the stories of the foundings of Togakushi and rewrites them in a way that matches the interests of the community at the time. And within his version, you now have Enno Gyoza, who's visiting the site before Gakumon Gyoza and then transmitting Shugendo to Gakumon Gyoza. And so it's a complete rewriting of the past. And I guess I'll just end it by saying that he's doing something similar to, you know, the folklore scholars in the 20th century by kind of placing Shugendo in this sort of atemporal plane, or at least having ancient origins. But the reasons he's doing it are different, right? And for either case, those reasons match the time period in which they're written, right? And so he's responding to the interests of the Yamabushi at the mountain at the time, and the fact that Shugendo has become popular around the country and many people want to visit mountains because of Shugendo. And so it makes sense for him to say, well, this is one of the main centers of Shugendo. And so you can see over time, again, the influence of, I guess, coming back to the theme, right, of narrative, ritual, and institution being these vectors for the continuing development of Shugendo at Togakushi.
Great. Yeah, thank you. There's still so much to go through, but I think, yeah, we have taken too much of your time today. Thank you so much for this enlightening conversation. Before we say goodbye, can you tell us what your current projects are, or future projects you're thinking of working on from now on?
Sure. I've got two projects that I'm sort of in the early phases of. And both of them kind of lead from this first book, but in kind of different directions. One is looking more broadly at the image of the Yamabushi, as sort of a through storytelling, the cultural image, because on one hand, mountain ascetics, even before, you know, the emergence of Shugendo, were either sort of these glorified wonder workers, or these charlatans that were, you know, up to mischief in the mountains and probably up to no good, right? Mm-hmm. And then I see Shugendo, the formation of Shugendo, as being tied to reconstructing an image for them that's a much more positive one. And so beyond the case of Togakushi, I'd like to look at that transformation over time. So that's one. And then the other project is quite different, but I guess it still remains in the sort of terrain of mountains, so to speak. It's just a different path and different time period. And I'm interested now in the modern period. So late 19th century, early 20th century, looking at what's happening with Shugendo as there's sort of early fits and starts of finding some way to practice it amid the ban. But also something that would appear totally different is at this time period, you also have the kind of advent of modern alpine climbing, and it's introduced through a number of British climbers in particular, and quickly takes off among Japanese intellectuals, especially based in Tokyo. And these two activities, sort of mountain worship and mountain alpinism, are often viewed as sort of separate spheres, or even, you know, one replacing the other. And I'd like to kind of challenge that idea a bit. And so this project is basically finding some intersections between these two spheres, both in sort of social networks and also ideas and interests and whatnot. So that's the other project that I'm kind of just beginning. I'll also note, just I guess just to finish this interview, coming back to the book. Okay, so here's a treat for those of you who have stuck around for this whole interview. appreciate your patience. In the book, in the index, I snuck in a few Easter eggs. I've only told, you know, some of my students about this and a couple of close friends, but now I'm going to share it a bit more widely. Easter egg meaning, there are a couple erroneous entries in the index. Also, I haven't told this to Hawaii Press, so I apologize in advance if once they find out about this. But there's a couple erroneous entries. But if you have some knowledge of Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, or Buddhism more broadly, then they provide clues in terms of page numbers and entries. So there's three of those. And what I've decided to do is I'll be visiting Togakushi this fall, and I'll purchase a number of kind of paper amulets with Kuzu-ryu, the nine-headed dragon, on them. And for the first, I guess I'm going to say 10 people that can identify them and let me know, then I'll send you this talisman from Togakushi, and it can bring you good fortune in your future endeavors. So yeah. And you can find my email address on my profile page at IMAP and IDOC.
Great, thank you. And on that note, please do search for those Easter eggs and look forward for Caleb's future projects. And I'll see you next time.